From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Congress is on break. The president is at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida. But the political world will not stay quiet for long because the impeachment trial could start in the Senate very soon after lawmakers return.
So let's bring in NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hey, good to be with you, Jeremy.
So the Senate left without an agreement on procedures for a Senate trial, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi hasn't decided when she will send over the two articles of impeachment approved last week, or at least she hasn't announced when she will do that. But there is reporting that she could pass those articles over to the Senate very quickly after lawmakers return to Washington. What do we know?
She's not likely to convey those articles before Congress gets back in the first week of January, and probably not for at least a few days after that. Remember, the House still needs to officially designate its team to act as impeachment managers in the Senate. So that'll be, say, Chairman Adam Schiff, maybe Jerry Nadler from the Judiciary Committee, and several more. So that has to happen, too. And the real pressure here is really on the Senate to decide how it wants to handle the procedure so the trial can proceed. The two party leaders in the Senate have to get past what they're calling an impasse. And in the meantime, the president continues to rage against it all every chance he gets.
Well, and when it comes to how that trial is going to go, there's a question about whether there will be witnesses. Democrats want them. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, doesn't. But in an interview on Tuesday with KTUU in Alaska, Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski said she was disturbed by McConnell saying that he was working in total coordination with the White House on impeachment.
To me, it means that we have to take that step back from being hand in glove with the defense. And so I heard what Leader McConnell had said. I happen to think that that has further confused the process.
Ron, is that a signal that Murkowski wants a trial with witnesses? And do you think other Republican senators would join her in demanding that, if so?
It may signal that. And it may signal that she's had those conversations with several other senators who would like to have the idea breached that this should be done with witnesses. So she might be a vote for that if it comes to a vote on the Senate floor, and it could. On the other hand, when she says working hand in glove, very carefully chosen words, clearly disapproving or implying disapproval of the way McConnell has dropped all pretense of being some sort of an arbiter or a juror here. McConnell has declared himself anything but impartial, and he's done it quite openly, and that clearly disturbs Senator Murkowski and some others.
Well, what are those other Republicans who may follow her?
You would have to look at someone like Mitt Romney in Utah, who has certainly kept his distance from Trump in many respects. You'd have to look at Susan Collins from Maine because she has a very tough reelection campaign and has a reputation for a moderate, although she has not always followed that in confrontations with the president. And also perhaps Cory Gardner from Colorado, another Republican facing a very tough reelection campaign this year or in 2020.
Okay, so let's play that out. Let's say those Republicans do come along and they say, yes, we want more witnesses. What would that look like? Would that mean that if the Democrats get John Bolton and Mick Mulvaney, that the Republicans would then get someone like Hunter Biden or Adam Schiff?
It might mean Bolton and Mulvaney, as they were involved with the aid to Ukraine being held up directly. And they are material witnesses, fact witnesses, who would be needed if this were a conventional trial and you were actually trying to get at the reality of what happened. Adam Schiff, we mentioned, might be a witness regarding the process in the House and his alleged contacts, direct or indirect, with the whistleblower who started all this. That's something the Republicans have alleged and like to talk about. Hunter Biden might be called if there were a Senate committee investigating corruption or alleged corruption in Ukraine and his role with one company there. But he would not be in a position to have any direct knowledge of how the president said, we need a favor, though, or held up the aid to Ukraine or withheld that meeting at the White House. All the things that are actually contained in the impeachment articles, he wouldn't have any knowledge of that.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Ron. There's a court hearing next week on the House Judiciary Committee's bid to force testimony from former White House counsel Don McGahn. This is actually related to the Mueller investigation. What are you expecting there?
It's important to remember the committee has not closed the books on possible additional articles of impeachment. And one they had considered was obstruction of justice, based on some of what's in the Mueller report and what came out last spring. And you remember that list of potential instances of obstruction of justice that Mueller was talking about. He said he couldn't indict a sitting president, but he said he was not exonerating him either. And he listed those things that Trump had done, and that included trying to get Don McGahn, who was at that time the White House counsel, to do something about Mueller, to get somebody to get rid of him. That would be obstruction of justice, and it's at least one of the things that the committee wants McGahn to testify about and that could produce yet another additional article of impeachment at some point. Hmm. So if this court, this three-person court in the District of Columbia, Circuit of Appeals, if they say he has to testify, well, we can expect the White House to appeal to the Supreme Court.
Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent. Ron, thank you and Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you, Jeremy and Peter.
All right. Happy New Year. And let's get to our last social media roundup of the year with Femi OK. She is the host. Yes. Well, there is a debate about that, by the way. Is it the end of the decade or not?
I saw that on Twitter. Yeah, the people should go and see Peter's Twitter, and then you can have that debate. It confused me about when does the decade start.
Okay, let's not even get into that right now.
Well, all I know is that the songs from 1990 never air on the 80s on 8 channel on Sirius XM, Femi, so there's that.
We digress massively. Let's talk about social media. Wait, okay, we have stuff to do.
Well, okay, let's talk about then the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who is trending on social media, and here's why. President Trump tweeted last night about his own cameo being edited out of the 1992 Christmas movie Home Alone 2: Lost in New York. This was done supposedly, he says, by broadcasters in Canada. Here's that scene, by the way.
Excuse me, where's the lobby?
Down the hall and to the left.
Thanks.
Okay, so that's it. But the scene's no longer there. It was apparently cut in 2014 before Trump was even president. And in the president's tweet today or last night, he said this sort of hints Justin Trudeau had something to do with this.
So this is a massive story overnight on Twitter. I'm always looking to see what's trending just before the Here and Now social buzz segment. So trending overnight, hashtag Trudeau, hashtag Home Alone 2. Over 100,000 people were tweeting about Home Alone 2 and the edits. So much so that CBC News jumped online to say when CBC acquired the broadcast rights to Home Alone 2 in 2014, several edits were made to adapt the movie for TV. So basically they were saving time because they had to put ads in. But it started a huge conversation online about the nature of CBC and if this was a political move. For instance, Skim was saying to CBC News, I'm sure if Obama was in the scene, they wouldn't edit the scene. Okay, going political straight away. And then on the other side of the aisle, we have The Cake Is a Lie, that's their Twitter handle, saying the scene with Trump was a cameo that added nothing to the plot of the film. And so it goes on and on. Let me leave the last word with President Trump, who says, the movie will never be the same, parentheses, just kidding.
I have seen that movie many, many times.
It was a 4-second
scene. And it is
scene.
Not crucial to the plot. He doesn't need to know where the lobby is in the plaza.
But thank you for playing it. Now I feel complete.
Okay, so let's talk about another movie that is getting a lot of attention, Femi, and that would be Cats, which everybody is very unhappy about. Take a listen to this.
Touch me, it's so easy to leave me.
Okay, that's Jennifer Hudson singing in the new movie. What are people saying about this? Why do they hate it so much?
Well, this has been a viral sensation ever since the first trailer came out in the summer. So let me just take you back to July. Greg McLennan says that he saw the Cats trailer and he saw the comments on YouTube. I went to watch The Lion King in the cinema, so this was in the summer. This trailer came on, kids were literally screaming and crying and people were leaving. So a viral sensation already. People were scared of the trailer, basically because it was grown adults, very well-known celebrities, stars, actors, dressed up as cats, and pretty anatomically correct for the most part. There's a whole sort of story about CGI and how it was used to change the way people look. But basically, the cats in the movie, their ears waggle, their tails waggle, all because of CGI. And people were kind of spooked out about this. And the reviews came in and they weren't on the whole good. Well, Ian Rannan, for instance, says the best comment on Cats the movie, and he said, they showed this movie on an airplane, I would still walk out.
Oh, use that emergency slide.
Yeah, I shouldn't really laugh at that. I have seen the movie. Colleagues over at Wait, say, I know it's been a couple of days, but we just wanted to do a wellness check on everyone who saw the Cats trailer. Anyone need to talk? Pet rescue centres are also jumping in. So people are loving the terrible reviews. So read the reviews. They're hilarious, even if you love Cats the movie. And what people are saying basically is, if you've ever seen the stage show, you know what you're in for. It is an unusual stage show, an unusual musical. Expect it to be unusual on the big screen too.
I saw the trailer and I was intrigued as well. I haven't seen it yet though.
I've seen it.
Femi finally, and just quickly, fans are remembering the Grammy winning songwriter who helped Earth, Wind and Fire with this hit. What are you seeing about Allie Willis today, known for this song, September, in 1978?
Lots of colleagues, lots of people from the industry saying things like Diane Warren was saying here. What a talent, what a character, what a loss. Resting musical power, Allie Willis. Amazing songwriter. Do look online. You can see some of her work there and some of the wonderful comments people are saying about her.
Femi, Happy New Year.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Talk to you later. This is Here and Now. Here we are with just about 4 days left in the 2010s. The decade started with President Obama in office. Democrats had huge majorities in both the House and Senate. It ends with President Trump in office, Democrats back in control of the House, and Republicans with a slight majority in the Senate. But the 2010s have been about a lot more than politics. And joining us to look at that is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Derek.
Great to be here. Thank you, Jeremy.
And so many things have happened in the 2010s, and we've sort of narrowed them down to several categories. But let's start with the economy, which is something that you pay a lot of attention to. We've been through so much in this decade. What has this decade meant for the U.S. economy?
Well, across categories, I think it's been a Rashomon decade, a decade where depending on how you choose to look at it, things look very, very different. So in terms of the economy, it's absolutely been a Rashomon decade. It's been one of the best decades the past half century, or it's been utterly dreadful. So on the bright side, unemployment's about 3.5%. That's extremely low, one of the lowest in 60 years. Wage growth is accelerating for the low income. We've added jobs for more consecutive months than any period in American history. Consumer sentiment is high. Inflation is low. Stocks have tripled in the last 10 years. This is pretty cool if you've been lucky enough to have savings in corporate equities. So altogether, it really seems like a pretty strong economy heading into the next decade. On the other hand, there's this dark side. You don't have enough homes that are being built, and as a result, millennials and Gen Z don't have a chance to build wealth the same way that older generations have. It's created this angry and politically motivated young cohort that feels, I think rightly so, like it's been somewhat screwed over by the Great Recession and its aftermath. You still have really high poverty, high poverty rates for working families, high poverty rates for children that haven't been ameliorated by this long recovery. So it's this rare decade that's been all growth and no recession, but it's not entirely clear how good it's been for tens of millions of people in the lower rungs. So again, a Rashomon decade.
But whether the decade has been good or bad for you economically, you're almost certainly addicted to your mobile device. So let's talk about the decade in technology. There's been so much technological change. I remember I got my first iPhone, first smartphone, really, back in 2008, right before this decade. But let's listen back to the man who was behind that, Apple CEO Steve Jobs, who passed away this decade. And here he is speaking in 2010, a year before he died, at the All Things Digital Conference, talking about what he and his employees do.
We come into work wanting to do the same thing today as we did 5 or 10 years ago, which is build the best products for people. You know, there's nothing that makes my day more than getting an email from some random person in the universe who just bought an iPad over in the UK and tells me the story about how it's the coolest product they've ever brought home, you know, in their lives. That's what keeps me going.
Derek, Steve Jobs could certainly see into the future to some degree, but I think even he would be surprised at how much we are relying on his devices and devices like them when it comes to Uber, Maps, mobile payments, etc. What has this decade meant for technology.
It's been a decade of magic and a decade of great disappointment. So again, I think there's two ways you can look at this. You can look at the fact that smartphones have become clearly the most important, most consequential consumer product maybe in the last 50 years, maybe in human history, when you think about all the things that someone can do with their smartphone, that they can read the news, that they can send money, that it's not just replacing, you know, newspapers and magazines in the U.S., it's replacing banking systems across Africa. So on the one hand, you have this magic that's been unleashed by the smartphone, social media, app world. At the same time, I think this has been a decade of tremendous disappointment in the tech community. And you can think of it as the tech's sins of commission and sins of omission. Hmm. So the sins of commission we talk about all the time. It's Facebook and misinformation. It's the privacy scandals regarding our smartphones and the Internet of Things. It's the dangerously narcotizing effects of social media, not just on your, you know, average adult, but especially on young teenagers. But I also, this month in The Atlantic, focused on the sins of omission among the tech community. In many ways, since the invention of the smartphone, or at least the iPhone, over a decade ago, has actually been a surprisingly stagnant decade, I think, technologically speaking. A lot of the things that we were promised, whether it was AI or self-driving cars or automation, they didn't materialize. And what we got instead are a lot of apps that make our life slightly more convenient, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, Uber or Lyft or DoorDash, but don't dramatically transform the city. I would argue that Silicon Valley, in many ways, has sunk a lot of talent and treasure in the last decade into solving problems that just don't matter that much, like advertising technology. And I think they would say, well, look, it's difficult to make a profit trying to transform the physical world. And I would agree with them. It is difficult and expensive to try to transform the physical world, but still they have failed. So, you know, this depresses me somewhat. I say this as a criticism of Silicon Valley, but I also say it as a means of galvanizing them. I think America is better off being technologically optimistic. And I think that in many ways, this decade was strange and paradoxical in that smartphones became ubiquitous, but so did an element of tech pessimism.
I have to say that I feel a little bit guilty now just about every time I look at social media, that I'm wasting minutes of my life looking at this thing that if I were to miss it, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it's the way that I put it in my column for The Atlantic is that for the last 10 years, we have seen an industrial revolution in convenience. And I mean that in a good and bad way. I mean, an industrial revolution in convenience in terms of Google conveniently organizes all the world's information. And you look at Uber, Lyft, how in the world could you argue that that hasn't made getting around a city more convenient? But I am hoping for an industrial revolution in something more than convenience in the next decade or in the next generation. I think we need more technology around energy generation and energy storage, more technology around advancing artificial intelligence, and more technology to sort of revitalize the physical world. It both astonishes and somewhat depresses me that when you go outside and you look at skyscrapers and cars and you hear planes overhead and feel the rumble of the subway below your feet, these are all inventions of the late 19th century.
Right.
These are 130-year-old inventions. Let's invent something new for the physical environment in the next generation and not just add more software to our phones.
All right, Derek, let's talk about another topic that you spend a lot of time thinking about, and that is entertainment. At the start of the decade, the Academy Award for Best Picture went to The Hurt Locker, a film about an American bomb disposal team in the Iraq War.
You realize every time you suit up, it's life or death.
And fast forward to today.
Bounty hunting is a complicated profession.
That is from The Mandalorian on Disney's new streaming service, Disney Plus. So much has changed. You know, the rise of... Were we still getting Netflix DVDs mailed to us at the beginning of the decade? I can't remember.
I think some of us were. Some of us were streaming. But if we were streaming, we were streaming shows and movies that Netflix didn't own. 10 years ago, Netflix did not have any original content. But since Netflix made the decision about a decade ago to buy original content, like House of Cards, it has transformed the entire visual entertainment world. And now it is obvious to everybody that the future of TV and film will be streamed. On the one hand, yes, Disney still does release $1 billion blockbusters, it seems like, every 3 months. It just released another one that will surely earn $1 billion in the last Star Wars movie. But Disney has gotten into the streaming wars with Netflix, and it is a crowded, crowded space. Amazon is there. Apple is there. NBC is there. Time Warner with HBO is jumping in. And so you really see that the cable bundle, which was in many ways one of the most important cultural totems of the second half of the 20th century, is being undercut by a future that will be streamed. And that will have just absolutely fascinating implications for advertising. And it also, I think, has really important implications for how America thinks of itself as being sort of a single nation or community when it comes to entertainment. You know, 90 million of us, 100 million of us used to watch sitcoms and dramas, and now we all stream from one of several hundred new dramas that come out on a variety of streaming sites. So we are becoming fragmented, not only politically, but also in terms of our entertainment.
But there's so much good TV out there right now, I must say.
There is.
With all of this change happening over the last decade, of course, a lot of the attention has just been on politics, not just in this country, but around the world. And in terms of what's next, you ask, is this the beginning of a Cold War between the U.S. and China? What do you think?
I don't know, Jeremy, but it concerns me what we're seeing right now between the U.S. and China. I think on the one hand, you have a United States that doesn't really know entirely what it stands for, that is deeply polarized between a far right or at least a conservative wing that is dominated by white voters and a socialist wing of the Democratic Party that is more diverse but that is young and angry and stands for very little of that which the sort of Trumpist wing of the Republican Party is standing for. So I think that the U.S. is at least politically at each other's throats. And at the same time, you see that China itself might be sort of coming apart at the seams between Hong Kong and the fact that the Chinese government from Beijing is waging essentially a kind of genocide against the Uyghur population in Xinjiang. It has its own internal problems. So, you know, a lot of times when people focus on, you know, the geopolitical showdown between the U.S. and China, they focus on the relationship between the U.S. and China. But I think many of the things that are driving the insecurity of this relationship is the fact that each of these countries are going through their own political turmoil internally.
That is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks so much, as always, and Happy New Year.
Jeremy, Happy New Year. You got that dream.
So how would you describe this past decade? Tell us what you'll be remembering at hereandnow.org. A moment now for model train enthusiasts. Clubs across the country are pushing the hobby full throttle into the future. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Aaron Scott reports from the Pacific Northwest's biggest group.
There's a building in North Portland that stands out because it looks like a train depot, but there are no train tracks to be seen. At least, not unless you get invited inside. Since 1947, the Columbia Gorge Model Railroad Club has built an enormous replica of Portland and the Columbia River Gorge. Thousands of feet of tiny tracks circle through mountains and valleys, cross over bridges, and pass meticulous recreations of some of the region's iconic places. Isaac Harpool Jr. is the club's chairman.
There's no way in the world I could build something like this at my house. Couldn't afford it. So you join up with everybody else, and we come down here and just have a blast.
Go to it. Have fun.
The club has around 150 members who meet weekly. Some just want to run trains. Others are more interested in creating the intricate scenery. Members make most of the towns and landscape themselves, working off photos or even architectural plans in the case of well-known buildings like Portland's historic passenger train station.
There we go.
For Cynthia Leonard, no detail is too small.
This is a new animation that we put in this year.
She shows off a circle of plastic chickens the size of rice grains, all bobbing up and down.
It's a little magnet that goes around and makes them peck. There's something about recreating the world in a very small sort of way. It makes it very manageable.
Do you ever have fantasies of King Kong or Godzilla?
Yeah, everybody, that's one thing that we're always talking about is like walking across like King Kong and, Godzilla actually, and doing the whole Tokyo bit.
Like Godzilla, trains are captivating in part because of their size and power. The goal of the club feels like a paradox, then, to replicate that same sense of awe on the smallest of scales. They do it through an intricate web of technology and imagination. New electronic upgrades mean multiple trains can be tracked and operated via digital monitors, and they pass through small scenes with little, often whimsical, surprises. A drive-in theater that screens real movies, a Boy Scout troop that stumbles across a dinosaur, and Bigfoot lurking by Multnomah Falls. Members are even using Google Earth and 3D printing to make more realistic replicas. Leonard says this perpetual innovation draws in new members.
The stereotype is old, retired white guys. And there's quite a bit of truth to that. But the hobby is expanding.
There we go.
13-year-old Damarian Brown is reconnecting a web of wires under the model when Harpole Jr., his grandfather, comes to check on his progress.
I have to go over to the power room where we turn on the layout, flip a switch that turns on all the building lights, and then in Hood River, all these lights should light up.
We'll check it out.
They head back up to the Hood River portion of the model.
Okay, which ones did you do?
I did basically this whole street right here, all the houses. The church is lit up right now.
Oh, yeah.
The drugstore is lit up.
That looks good. Good job. Thank you.
Harpole Jr.'s father originally brought him to the club as a kid. Now he's done the same with his grandson, who is one of several teens.
That way we constantly have younger members coming up through the system, learning how to do things, so that comes their time, they get to take over as we move on off into the sunset. Back to the caboose and down the track, you know?
For Here and Now, I'm Aaron Scott.
We are just days away from 2020, and you may be thinking about a New Year's resolution, how you might improve your life. And yes, I know resolutions usually fail, but in the spirit of optimism, we thought we'd take a look at a few places around the world where people commonly live long and healthy lives well past 100 years. Dan Buettner is a National Geographic Fellow. He's visited these places, which he calls Blue Zones, and he's author of the book Blue Zones Kitchen, 100 Recipes to Live to 100. Dan, welcome and happy holidays.
It's a delight to be here.
All right. And why are these places where people are living happily into old age called Blue Zones?
Well, we know they live a long time and found them almost 20 years ago. Originated the original Blue Zone in Sardinia. The demographer we worked with was using a blue pen as he drew concentric circles on a map as we zeroed in on the Blue Zone, the area with the highest concentration of male centenarians in the world.
And so what was the secret in Sardinia?
The women wear the pants there, so there's a theory that the men live a long time there, but women carry the stress. It's a matriarchal community. They have a type of wine called Cannonau that has the highest levels, known highest levels of polyphenols in the world. And the longevity phenomena is not found among the farmers. It's only found among the shepherds. And they're doing regular low-intensity physical activity every day and taking naps.
Wow. So since then, you found others. You've gone to the island of Icaria in Greece, Okinawa, Japan, in Costa Rica, the Nicoya Peninsula. Is there something that these places have in common? They're all by the ocean. Are they eating fish?
Actually, all the Blue Zones, the island Blue Zones, the populations are away from the sea. Actually, they ate very little seafood. The organizing principle in all of these Blue Zones, and I've written about this for 15 years, is not that they try to live longer. It ensues from living in the right environment. But still, at a certain point, I realized that the entry point for most people when they're thinking about healthier habits is through their mouth. That's why I wrote the Blue Zone Kitchen and specifically focused on what centenarians ate over the last 100 years that explains their longevity.
Then there was Loma Linda, California, where there's a group of Seventh-day Adventists who live about a decade longer than most other Americans. Were you surprised at all to find one of these in the United States?
Well, we went out searching for it, and we used data from the National Institutes on Health. We first focused in Minnesota, where I'm from. You have a very high concentration of centenarians. That's because the young people have left. But there's something about these Adventists. You know, they tend to celebrate their Sabbath on Saturday, so they have one day where they completely downshift. And they take their diet directly from the Bible, Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, where God talks about every plant that bears seeds and every tree that bears fruit. So they're mostly vegetarian or vegan. And that, we believe, explains some of their extraordinary life expectancy.
So these people are living a long time, but are they happy?
About 80% of the same factors that get you to a healthy age, 95, say, are also the ones that make you happy. So the ingredients going on in these blue zones are they have a sense of purpose. They have strong social network. They tend to be religious. They live in communities where every time they go to work or to school or to friend's house, it occasions a walk. So, you know, these are places where they're living quality lives for a long time and avoiding the diseases that are killing Americans.
Are the people who are living in these blue zones still living this way? In other words, like, are the younger generations prone to the sedentary lifestyles and the junk food that the rest of us are?
They are, because this 500-year tradition of eating is disappearing. And probably within a half a generation, there'll be no more blue zones.
Now, I understand you've tried to take this to different neighborhoods across the country. Are you able to replicate what's going on in Sardinia in a place like Minnesota?
Yes. So I have a big team of about 150 people and entire cities like Fort Worth, Texas, and Orlando, Florida, and areas in Los Angeles have brought us aboard to lower obesity rates and lower smoking rates and increase physical activity levels. But again, the secret goes back to this notion that if you try to change your behavior, you're beating a dead horse. Mm-hmm. But you can change people's environments to make the healthy choice the easy choice or the unavoidable choice. And when you systematically do that through the food systems and the built environment, tobacco environment, you can really get a lot done in a 3 to 5 year time horizon.
And how are you doing that?
Well, my teams have 3 squads. We have 1 squad that works with city council to adopt policies that favor healthy food over junk food, favor the pedestrian over the motorist, and favor the smoker over the non-smoker. And then we administer a blue zone certification programs for restaurants, schools, grocery stores, churches, and workplaces so that when those places change their policy and their designs to nudge people into moving more and eating less, we reward them with certification. And then a third squad works with about 15% of the adult population to help them find their sense of purpose. And we put them in these committed social circles we call MOI. So it's people, places, and policy. You have to stick to it for 3 to 5 years. But every city we've worked in, and we've worked in about 50 American cities, we've seen their health outcomes improve.
I see a survey that you've written about from Naples, Florida. 17% of the people who participated said that they lost weight. Nearly 70% said that they made new friends. I assume this is not a scientific study. But again, the problem seems to be that if you live in a traditional blue zone, you've been living this way your entire life since the day that you were born. The challenge for these folks is to do it late in life. So how hard is it for people to stick with it?
Well, diets fail for 97% of people who try them because you're depending on your own willpower and discipline and you're doing it in a vacuum. So the idea behind this group in Naples, we got 140 people to agree to join a social circle, a MOI. We coupled them with 4 or 5 other people, and we simply challenged them to eat plant-based food for 3 months. And actually, the results were astounding. We saw people begin to reverse diabetes. One lady lost 37 pounds, and collectively, we saw their life expectancy go up by almost a century in just 3 months.
So someone may be listening to this. It's the end of the year. We're at the dawn of a new decade even, and you know it's resolution time. What do you suggest someone does if they say, I want to try to live like this?
Yeah, first of all, accept the notion that eating a whole plant-based diet is going to lessen your chance of disease. If your resolution should not be, I'm going to cut calories, it should be, no, I'm going to learn a half a dozen plant-based recipes that I like, because if you taste them and you'll like them, you'll keep doing it. And finally, if you create a social network of people who also enjoy these types of food. So if you're getting together with people around hamburgers and baby back ribs, that's what you're going to eat. Whereas if you get around vegetarians and vegans or people who share a blue zone dietary approach, it's going to be mindless when you get together with them that you're going to eat healthier foods without trying.
But if
and
you're
that
not,
will last.
But if you're not used to eating a plant-based diet and you like to have burgers and ribs, what do you do?
Again, I think you have to try some new recipes until you find one you like. I mean, the idea behind this book is we gathered 100 recipes from Italy and Greece and Asia and Latin America. So no matter what your palate is, you know, the secret to making plant-based food taste good is oil, herbs, and spices. So we don't know how to make beans taste good in this country. People in Blue Zones make these beautiful stews and minestrones and these salads out of beans that are beautifully spiced and baked. And, you know, if we took the culinary effort we put into bone marrow and pork belly, it'd be no problem finding foods, even for carnivores, that they love to eat that aren't going to better their chance of heart disease or cancer or diabetes.
Now, do you live this way, eat this way?
I do. I just had beans for breakfast, believe it, and then a smoothie with blueberries, and I'm looking at it right now, with blueberries and spinach in it and a little bit of soy milk.
All right. Well, Dan Buettner, I wish you a happy 2020 and a long life. You're a National Geographic fellow and author of the Blue Zones Kitchen 100 Recipes to Live to 100. Thank you so much.
All right. We'll see you when you're 100.
I hope so. Dan loves his beans. He eats up to a cup every day, so that may not be for everybody. Anyways, if you do have a secret for a long and happy life and you want to share it with us, we're at hereandnow.org.
Our next story is about a government employee in Washington, D.C. named Nico DeMarco. He's got a creative side gig. He's a DJ and a rather successful one at that. But if you met him on the street, you might not expect him to have a career in music because DeMarco is completely deaf. Here's Michaela Lefrak of WAMU.
Nico DeMarco has loved music ever since he was a little kid. He and his brothers would pile into their mom's car and put the radio on full blast. His mom would move the dial until she got to one of his favorite channels, late 90s pop or hip hop. The car would vibrate with sound.
And I'd find a rhythm and tell my mom, stay with that channel.
Were you a NSYNC or a Backstreet Boys kind of guy?
Oh, I can't pick one. I can't pick one.
DeMarco can't hear music. The voice you're hearing is an American Sign Language interpreter who sat in on our interviews. But the 30-year-old DJ can feel the vibrations thumping through his body. That's why he was always asking his mom to turn up the music, pump up the bass.
We tell her to turn it on full blast, put it on max. My family was always pretty surprised, saying, are you sure you don't hear?
He's sure. He can't hear melody, lyrics, anything. His whole immediate family is deaf, too. His twin brother, Niall, is a model who's become pretty famous after becoming the first deaf winner of the TV shows Dancing with the Stars and America's Next Top Model. DeMarco went to Gallaudet University in Northeast D.C. Most of its student body is deaf and hard of hearing. He loved the culture there.
I'd rather just have it up front. Hey, I'm a deaf DJ. I'm proud to be deaf.
D.C. has one of the largest communities of deaf and hard-of-hearing people in the country due to Gallaudet. DeMarco started DJing when he was in college there. Through technology, music is a big part of campus life. Audiology professor Larry Medwetsky is hard-of-hearing himself. He says if you walk around campus today, you'll see lots of kids with headphones on.
You didn't see that before, but the output levels are such that they can hear it or feeling it in their ears. But they're enjoying music.
Undergrads blast music at their parties and hire DJs like DeMarco to play at events. There's even a device that people can wear on their backs that helps transmit musical vibrations into their bodies.
The more deeper sounds are being perceived lower in the body, and the higher pitch notes are being perceived higher up, like in the neck area, so it can flow up and down. That's what makes the experience more enjoyable.
DeMarco doesn't wear one of those devices, but he does use huge subwoofers and amps to get the music pumping in his apartment and out at clubs.
Huge! If I turn it on, you're going to feel that. Your whole body will feel that rhythm.
The technology that really changed things for him was an iPhone app called Shazam. It came out more than 15 years ago. To use it, you hold your phone up as a song is playing, and the app identifies it almost immediately. When DeMarco feels a rhythm he likes, he Shazams it and checks out the lyrics. Sometimes he is shocked.
And I look at the lyrics sometimes and I'm thinking, well, what? That's not a song for everyone.
Unintentionally playing a scandalous song in front of kids or at a wedding? That's one challenge of being a deaf DJ. Another one is volume. When he DJs for mixed audiences, sometimes the hearing people can't handle the level of sound that deaf people need in order to feel the music. DeMarco's learned to keep earplugs around to hand out. But a lot of times, audiences don't even know he's deaf. I went to see him DJ at a brewery earlier this year, and people in the crowd, like Josh Baker and Kelsey Dwyer, were really surprised to find out.
It's amazing, because like I didn't even know until you said anything that he was deaf. So it's not like any different experience from like the listener perspective.
And he's obviously doing an awesome job, so it's cool. Yeah.
DeMarco also loves inspiring deaf and hard of hearing people to dance. His Instagram is filled with videos of him dancing, and his most requested songs usually have set choreography, think electric slide. People just feel more confident when they know what dance moves to do. The number one request he gets? A little song called The Wobble by VIC. All the shawty's in the club, let me see you
dance. Back it up, drop it down, let me. People will go nuts and jump on the floor to dance to that because they know how to dance to that song. It's a deaf thing.
It's kind of an everyone thing. DeMarco still works full-time as a government IT specialist and DJs in the evenings and on weekends. He's really happy with the life he's created in D.C.
Well, I don't mind being a deaf DJ because, you know, very often people don't get that deaf people can do anything. So I just try to represent my community and do everything I can to help them visualize a future that's broad, without limits.
For Here and Now, I'm Michaela LaFrac.
What a great story. Well, we want to take a moment now to thank our Washington, D.C. intern, Alexander Turk, who is wrapping up his internship so he can finish school at the University of Maryland. He will also be continuing his work at NPR. Mm. And based on the talent and drive that he has shown us in his time at Here and Now, I'm sure we're going to be hearing a lot more from him.
Indeed. Good luck, Alex.
Good luck, Alex. And also want to thank our technical directors, Mike Moschetto and James Trout, keeping the show on the air today despite colossal technical difficulties.
We made it.
But here we are. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Looking at something like a truth, yeah. A girl told me that a man that could dance might could possibly get down with the tool in his pants.